Good morning. Please be seated. Our first case is case number 54038, Chester Stiles versus State of Nevada. Before we proceed, I'm going to let you know Justice Michael Cherry is part of this panel. He will be participating in the decision of this case. Unfortunately, he was ill this morning. I talked to him. He's fine. He might even be in this afternoon, but he asked us to proceed, and he will listen to the audio tape of the arguments today here before we make any decision on the so Mr. Westbrook, you may proceed on behalf of Mr. Stiles.
Thank you, Your Honor. Morning, Justices. May it please the Court, my name is David Westbrook. I represent Mr. Stiles in this matter, the appellant. We must ensure that the laws are applied evenly and appropriately. In this case, as in every case, in order to protect the constitutional principles on which our legal system is based, we must guarantee justice, not just for this defendant, but for all who may be accused of a crime and subjected to the state's power to deprive them of life, liberty, or property hereafter. That's a quote from the Utah Supreme Court, State versus Warren Jeffs, a case that was reversed despite egregious facts, because it had to be. This is a case that has to be reversed because of violations of due process, the 4th, 5th, 6th, 14th Amendments, and primarily because the state was allowed to overreach and in doing so put the Constitution and Mr. Stiles' constitutional rights in jeopardy. The first decision in this case that made reversal inevitable was the decision to deny the motion to sever. This case is thought of in the media, where it got a lot of plays, I know that you're familiar, as the videotape case. It's the videotape case. A videotape was found in the desert. It's all on video.
Mr. Westbrook, my only concern was, even if the judge had severed, couldn't the state have requested the other offense come in as a under 48045 as a bad act, and wouldn't it a good chance it would eventually get in anyway?
Absolutely not.
Okay, tell me why.
I'll tell you why. And that's obviously of the first of my many assignments of error in this case. That tape would never have come in because it's inapplicable and it's inadmissible in the case involving Buchanan. This is the videotape case, but it shouldn't have been the videotape case. This is actually two cases, and they should have been treated separately. Now, as the court is aware, there are several ways that severance can be appropriate. I think I did a pretty fair job of dismissing the first two. This is clearly not a common scheme or plan. There's no relationship between the parties. I'd be glad to address those.
No, that's okay. We understand.
I suspect the court is focusing on the third thing. It wouldn't be cross-admissible.
Right.
The way that the state... one of the many arguments that they made in order to try to convince the district court that it would be cross-admissible. I'm sorry, before I go any further, I wanted to make it clear I was going to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. I checked with the clerk earlier and forgot to say it up front. I'm sorry.
Okay.
One of the ways that the state attempted to argue to the district court that it was cross-admissible is by creating defenses that were never going to be used by Mr. Stiles in the Buchanan case and saying, we have to put this evidence in order to fight off those defenses. Our case law is clear that the defenses have to be real, not absurd, and they actually have to be used by the defendant in order for them to allow cross-admissibility on a theory of, say, motive or identity. These were not issues in the case, and they never would have been under Buchanan. Buchanan was a very, very weak factual case. How weak? So weak that even here in Nevada, where police reports get filed on virtually everything, arrests get made on virtually everything, and the prosecution in Clark County prosecutes 85% or so of cases that come in, there was no arrest made in the Buchanan case. Not until months and months and months later when the rest of this videotape information came to the forefront of the media. Mr. Stiles was interviewed by the police. The alleged victim was interviewed by the police, and her entire family was interviewed. And it resulted in no arrest, because the case was too weak to sustain even an arrest on its own. Mm-hmm. When you introduce a case that has videotape into a case that has virtually no evidence, when you do your harmless error analysis, you have to look at the perspective of the weaker case. And I know harmless error analysis will be done, at least as regards to the severance issue. I think there are other issues in which harmless error analysis was structural constitutional error and shouldn't even apply. But as far as the severance issue, if you look at the effect of the Buchanan charges in the Madison or in the Moffitt case, then an argument can be made that it was overwhelming evidence. And even though that might have been a mistake, perhaps it didn't affect the outcome. I disagree with that. I think it did affect the outcome. But that argument can certainly be made. However, there's no way to make a credible, intellectually honest argument that there was, you know, insufficient prejudice from the introduction of the video into the Buchanan case. The Buchanan case was wholly unrelated. In fact, the officer who interviewed the alleged victim in the Buchanan case said that she was inconsistent. She wasn't able to tell the truth from a lie. Arguably, she wasn't competent to testify. Didn't become an issue, but could have been had the case been severed, as it should have been. Another problem with cross-admissibility, well, first of all, there's no theory in which it would be cross-admissible. That's number one. The only theory, I think, that was posed out there, and I'm not even sure the district court acted based on this theory, but the only theory that was posed out there that even had a fighting chance, I think, was motive. But the problem is the state's motive argument was really just a propensity argument. I know the court referenced Ledbetter, which the court, this court should, again, realize Ledbetter. First of all, I think it's bad law. And the only thing that saves it from being bad law is the fact that it was it's in a bear trap. It can't move. It has been specifically limited based on its precise factual scenario, and that's right in the opinion.
Well, I think Ledbetter, and again, my colleagues, Justice Pickering and Cherry, weren't on the court when Ledbetter was issued. I was. I think the idea was with Ledbetter is to try and clarify Bronstein and Richmond, and there was kind of some doubt as to, you know, if conflicts in those cases, and maybe did a poor job of it, but I think that was the intent to try and do it. So what's your thoughts on Ledbetter, or what should the court look at?
Well, Your Honor, regarding Ledbetter, my concern is not with so much the words on the page, but how they've been interpreted since Ledbetter. It gets used a lot to try to get propensity evidence in front of juries. And this is just a fact of practice. Every side is looking for an advantage. Now, everyone has oaths and duties. The district attorney swears an oath to protect and uphold the Constitution. A lot of times, those oaths and duties take a backseat to trying to win. And if you're a prosecutor, you want other bad act evidence in when you try your case because it makes trying your case easier. The juries are told you can't consider this for propensity, but everyone knows it's what they do. And when you have a case involving a videotape that's intermingled with a case that involves virtually no evidence, and then you have an instruction, this is one of the most incredible instructions I've ever seen, and this alone warrants reversal. When you have an instruction from the court, which I reference in my brief on page 19, that says, use the evidence from the Madison-Moffitt incident in evaluating the evidence in the Buchanan incident, then you have propensity. Essentially, the court said, well, you can consider what happened in this completely unrelated case when you're evaluating the evidence in the Buchanan case. That's nothing more than a propensity instruction. It's not even a propensity instruction in disguise. It's just a propensity instruction. Ledbetter, I think, was misapplied in this case, and in applying Ledbetter, the court overstepped the boundaries that were specifically set in Ledbetter. And again,
what are those boundaries? I'm struggling with distinguishing Ledbetter from this case, and the debate over whether Ledbetter's good law or bad law is really not open to this panel.
Right. Well, whether Ledbetter is good law or bad law.
But distinguish it for me, if
sure.
You would.
Well, first of all, Ledbetter was specifically limited to its own facts, and that's right in the opinion. The other thing about Ledbetter is important.
But what about those facts distinguishes it from this case?
Well, for one thing, in Ledbetter, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, actually, Justice Gibbons, since you know the case better than I do. One of the things specifically in Ledbetter that I recall is that in Ledbetter, you actually had a testifying victim who was given the utmost incredibility. She told a consistent story. I believe it was a she. Told a consistent story that was consistent throughout. There was no indication that there was any tampering with that particular named victim in that case. In this case, involving Buchanan, you don't have any of that. You have somebody who the police officer specifically said was inconsistent, didn't know the truth from a lie, couldn't keep one story straight, and was completely confused about the events that allegedly happened with Mr. Stiles and some other event where somebody entered the house and her daddy got a gun. She specifically referenced that numerous times during her interview. So you don't have at all a similar factual scenario. What you do have is propensity being labeled motive and entering a case it shouldn't be in. Another problem with the severance is that it forced the defense attorneys in this case to go forward on a case in which they were simply not ready. There was a motion to continue based on the Buchanan case. The motion was fair. It was based on the need to investigate something incredibly serious, potential other suspects in the case. There was a history, according to several sources, of sexual abuse within the Buchanan family. It's easy to see where there could have been a mistake made by the complaining victim in the case. There could be a move to cover up by the family or to find a scapegoat. And we were not allowed to go into any of that and investigate in any real way because our motion to continue was denied. And it was denied in spite of the fact that the state had earlier indicated they would agree to it and the court had earlier indicated she would allow the severance.
Well, we had a case called Higgs versus State recently where the district court denied a motion to continue from Mr. Higgs. That was the one on the Kathy Augustine. And all. How would you distinguish this case from Higgs, you know, like as far as the judge exercising the discretion on whether or not to grant a continuance?
In a lot of cases, and I'm not sure if Higgs is one of these cases, you don't get a very good record made by defense counsel when they ask for a continuance. In this case, you had a precise record. The attorneys in this case went to great detail as to why they weren't ready on the Buchanan case. They did prepare on, I'm sorry, was it 20 counts, 23 counts of the Madison Moffitt case, which again is a completely unrelated case. It's not like you can share any of the research between the two. They have nothing to do with one another. They were dealing with CPS and other out-of-state agencies, including one in Washington State. We needed to send investigators out of state in order to look into this stuff, and we simply didn't have time.
There were four motions to continue, though. Were there not three of which postdated the receipt by the defense of the Washington CPS report, correct?
There were. I'm not sure, Judge. Your Honor. I'm not sure because it's such a large record, and I can't speak to that directly. However, even if there were, the point is some of these things take time, and this is such a huge case with such media scrutiny that being ready on the Moffitt case, and everyone announced ready on the Moffitt case, that was the majority and the bulk of the charges, was certainly adequate. I mean, we can't say that the defense attorneys, and really the lower court seemed to argue this and seemed to be personally offended somehow. If you read the language, I don't think I'm reading too much into it, seemed to be somehow personally offended that our attorneys weren't ready to go on the Buchanan case when they were ready to go on the case that makes up the vast majority of the charges. It was incredibly, completely reasonable for these dedicated attorneys to not be ready on that second case. And for a long time, it seemed like it was going to be severed. Everyone seemed to be on board, and then all of that changed. Okay. It wasn't as dramatic a change as when the court reversed its own summit decision in the middle of trial or decided to have a 51.385 hearing in the middle of trial, but it was a dramatic change, and our guys weren't ready.
Okay. Mr. Westbrook, I know you have a little over 2 minutes. We'll give you 5 minutes you asked for because of the magnitude of this case. Mr. Sweeten, we'll give you 18 minutes to equalize the argument.
Thank you, Justice Gibbons, Justice Pickering. James Sweeten on behalf of respondent from the District Attorney's Office. Justice, in regards to the Ledbetter decision, the state would submit that Ledbetter did clarify some things. And I think that one of the major things that it clarified was after some of the line of cases that were coming, it was questionable as to what the status of emotional propensity for sexual aberration evidence had in the state. And I think that Ledbetter, you know, made that very clear that in cases such as this, the state would submit it's probably pretty unusual that if you have another bad act that's admissible as relevant and under 48.045, that it doesn't have some emotional propensity for sexual aberration. And the state submits that the court's major concern is in regards to the probative value of that, whether it outweighs any prejudice. Now, in this case, the state would submit, as the court is focused on the cross-admissibility of these, that there certainly are clear reasons for the cross-admissibility of both of these. And I want to get into those. Before I get into those, I want to point out the state would submit that both of these cases were strong cases. In regards to the video case, the state would submit that clearly the defendant was on the video, although he had defenses in that regard. He was observed performing various acts. But in regards to the crimes against SB, we have SB's testimony at trial in regards to this. Remember, SB was about 11 years old when she testified. She was about 6 years old when this happened to her. We have the statements that she makes to her parents and others in the area just after the events occurred. Very excited statements. The state submits they're substantially probative. There's no reason to be dishonest. Nothing was shown in that regard. They describe specific sexual conduct in the way you would expect a child to describe that. Tina Allen observed the defendant. Remember in SB, or the defendant was in SB's bedroom in the middle of the night. Tina Allen, who was the defendant's girlfriend at the time, came upstairs in the middle of the night as she was going to the bathroom. She sees the defendant in the bedroom with the child and mentions that she has a grimace on her face. There were sexual assault findings, erythema on the inside of the labia minora, or a sort of a swelling or a redness, which is consistent with the touching that was indicated by the child, also consistent with a great many other things, soap in the bathtub, other various things. The defendant admitted to being in the victim's room, but denied being alone with her. Although we have Tina Allen, who testifies to us that she saw him in the room with her, certainly alone. And also, after being questioned by the police, the defendant was asked whether there was any reason why any of his bodily fluids or pubic hair would be in that bedroom where the child was sexually assaulted. And as a result of that, he makes a comment in regards to that he would be surprised, or he wouldn't be surprised if his pubic hairs were in that room, because when a person takes their shoes off at the end of the day, you would find pubic hairs in their socks. The state submits a very suspicious statement. The state submits, when you put all this together, the Buchanan case wasn't a weak case in any regard. Of course, both the MM case and the SB case had substantial holes to fill based upon potential inferences that might be made in the presentation of the evidence or defenses that might be raised.
So you would agree then with your colleague that this case differs from Ledbetter, viewed from the perspective of the Buchanan case, in that the evidence was not overwhelming?
No, I believe that the evidence in both cases was very strong. And my point is that it really doesn't differ in regards to the motive exception. But there's other exceptions as well. And I would note that maybe, you know, one of the exceptions would be that the acts committed against MM are admissible to show a lack of mistake or accident in regards to the acts committed against SB. You know, the evidence relative to the victim showed that SB was climbing all over the defendant. The defendant comes over to SB's house with her boyfriend. The defendant with his girlfriend. And as they come to the house, he then makes contact, essentially through his girlfriend, with the victim in this case. And as he makes that contact with the victim, his girlfriend testified in court that the child, SB, climbed on his lap, that she was kissing on him, that she called her boyfriend. She testified to all these things. The state submits that the jury could draw an inference from that, that SB caused the contact with the defendant, that maybe the touching alleged, but which is the defendant's tongue in the victim's mouth, as well as the defendant touching the vagina with the hand, could have been inadvertent and maybe a mistake or accident. And the state would submit that the defense clearly knew this, because the defense explored this on cross-examination of the defendant's routine out to some extent, basically describing that SB was the aggressor, supposedly, that she followed the defendant and was kissing him. They explored this in closing argument as they detailed out, and they spent a great time making clear that it was SB who climbed on the defendant's lap and kissed him. The evidence.
Now, SB was age 6 at this time?
That's correct. SB was age 6.
Okay.
But certainly that was an issue that was put out there by the defense in this matter, and something that was mm-hmm. certainly of concern to the state in presenting the evidence, something that was very relevant. Mm-hmm. The evidence shown in regards to MM, a state submit, was very probably in this, because it occurred in MM's bedroom as it occurred in SB's bedroom, a good chunk of the assault. The defendant made contact with both the victims through Tina Allen, his girlfriend. It all happened with both victims within a few months. Although SB and MM did not know each other at the time, the touching when the defendant kneeled next to SB's bed was very similar to that observed on the video of MM. The video starts in regards to MM with the defendant raising the young victim's dress, and then he subsequently touches her vaginal area, much as SB initially described to her parents as happening to her. The difference in regards to SB, the state would submit, was that Teen Allen, as we talked about earlier, came upstairs as the defendant was kneeling next to the young victim's bed. She beckoned to the defendant, "What are you doing there?" And as a result of that, the defendant stopped and left the room. It's also relevant, the state would submit, the acts committed against SB are admissible to show the defendant's identity in regards to the acts committed against MM. Now, remember, MM was the case in which the defendant was captured on video performing these acts. Mm-hmm. But due to her young age, MM wasn't able to testify at trial, and that video was the evidence that we had in regards to the defendant committing these acts. And one of the focuses of the defendant at trial was that he wasn't the guy in the video. The state suspected this might be coming because as the trial neared the trial date, the defendant did retain an expert in regards to the video. He did seek to review that video by the expert. There was even hearings that were conducted in front of the court that would give him access to that, and he did have access to that. He consulted with the state's expert in regards to that. Despite all that, the defense never presented any evidence in regards to the video itself through its expert not being accurate, but it did provide that during cross-examination and also in its closing. The defendant contested his identity. And as is laid out in the brief, he actually, in closing, had a portion of the movie, Forrest Gump, and showed Forrest Gump shaking hands with now-deceased President Richard Nixon and saying, well, hey, this was made up. Why couldn't this
be made up? Was it Nixon or Kennedy?
Okay. Maybe it was Kennedy. Okay. I apologize, Justin.
That's okay.
And the defendant specifically said that the government cannot say with certainty that the person in the VHS and DVD is the defendant. That was spoke in closing argument. Certainly this was an issue, and the evidence of the crime submitted committed in regards to SV, the state would submit, went a long way to fill that hole. Both crimes were committed, as we indicated, a few months of each other. The defendant gained access to the child through his girlfriend, Tina Allen. Both the children were under the age of 7. We've talked about the motive exception as well. And the state submits that certainly applies in this case. What motivated the defendant? And very similar to the Ledbetter case, we have a situation here where we're trying to figure that out because we have the defendant who arrives at both of these residences where these incidents happened or gains access to those residents and the children therein with his adult girlfriend, Tina Allen. To all appearances, he's an adult. He's got an adult girlfriend. He's going to these residences with his girlfriend. Mm-hmm. Defendant sold himself out to be the boyfriend of Tina Allen, an adult. What would motivate an adult man with an adult girlfriend to sexually abuse children? Or what motivated the defendant to sexually abuse children he met through his association with Tina Allen, his adult girlfriend? What was this motive? In having sexual conduct with children met while in the company of this adult girlfriend, the state submits the motivation was to use this relationship with Tina Allen to gain access to the children that he might sexually abuse. A state submits that it's as clear as it was in Ledbetter, certainly the evidence should be admissible for that purpose. Now, defense has made some issues in regards to the state bringing up these issues in regards to absence of mistake or identity, and that the defense not. Well, first of all, the state would point out that it's the prosecution's responsibility to make sure that the evidence is placed in a way that's understandable and relevant. Many times there are inferences in the presentation of the evidence that might be negative or somewhat negatively impact the clear view of the evidence. And to that regard, the state has to or has a responsibility to ferret those out, make sure the evidence is clear. Additionally, there's many times when the state obviously sees that, in fact, the defendant is going to potentially get into an area. And certainly in that regard, even though the state might not feel it's even relevant, the state will go into that area, certainly to make sure that it doesn't appear that the state is hiding anything. And that's the way that cases are tried. And the state would submit that certainly in this case, what we're talking about in regards to the absence of mistake, identity, motive, or identity, those two which defense says the state brings up, clearly the state had a responsibility to bring them up. But beyond that, in this case, we have clear evidence that that was the defendant's defense. I mean, he clearly, those were the bulk of his defenses in regards to these incidents the state would submit.
Mr. Sweeten, could you talk about that jury instruction and, again, that age-old problem? How do you draw the line between motivation and propensity and all what the state's perspective is on that?
Right. And there wasn't, as I recall, a specific jury instruction as defense counsel worded it. There was, in closing argument, I think that's what he makes reference to in his brief, in the course of closing argument, there was a PowerPoint. It's actually my PowerPoint, and I recall it. And in that PowerPoint, I did lay out that the jury could consider this other incident. And as soon as I did that, I immediately quantified that and laid out how they could consider it. They can consider it for absence of mistake and motive, as I argued it. So I clearly laid out the purposes for which they might be able to consider.
So was the standard jury instruction given about limitation on Petrocelli hearings and evidence and
yes,
all?
Yes, there was no specific instruction that says you can consider all this in the other case. Nothing like that. And in closing argument made clear the restrictions that were placed on using evidence crossways between the two cases. Now, there was mention made in regards to the continuance that was not granted in this case. And in regards to that continuance, the state would submit, as has been mentioned here, that in fact the defense did obtain a couple prior continuances. And on those prior continuances, the last of which, the court was very clear, you know, I want to try this case. I want to know what you have to do before we can try this case. And at that point, the defense laid out that, well, they wanted to do some follow-up in regards to, you indicated, Justice Pickering indicated CPS reports. And there was some statements that SB's mother had made years later after her and her family had moved to another state to someone that they were alleged. SB's mother always denied that. And there were a lot of other things that questioned the validity or the dependability of the individual who was saying she'd made those statements, as I think we've laid out in our argument, and I can maybe touch on a little bit later. But the state would submit that the court was very clear. How much time do you need for this? And it was the defense that says, well, we need about 90 days. And so the court says, fine, I'll give you 90 days. And I'm sorry, Justice, so I have 5 minutes left, or do I have 8 minutes left?
I think it's five. Yeah, I think we started with 18. Then.
Thank you, Justice. And in regards to that, They had 90 days, and at the time that they come back, we know that they've already made their motion to severance. They want to sever SB's case from MM's case, and now we come back to calendar call, the time when they said that they would be ready to go to trial, and now they say they're not ready to go to trial for a couple reasons. And the first reason was that they failed to hire a medical expert in regards to the sexual assault exam performed on SB. Now, as it laid out in my brief, the report had been on file for more than a year at that point. They had had access to it. And I would note that the state submits that it would be unusual for the defense to obtain an expert in this regard. And the reason for that is there were no findings by the sexual assault examiner in regards to SB except for this erythema that we talked about, which is basically a redness or swelling between the vaginal lips. The state would submit that that could be attributed to the touching that's consistent with what SB described, as well as a lot of other things. And the defense made that very clear when the state put forward their expert to testify in regards to the findings, that this particular finding could mean a great many things besides the touching. The state's not sure what an expert on behalf of defense could have accomplished that was not accomplished in regards to cross of the state's expert. They additionally mentioned this evidence that we talked about from out of state, and that would be the statement that SB's mother made to the friend and ultimately was reported to CPS. They'd had possession of this for a long time. The defendant was asked, when the trial was previously continued, how much time he needed. As we indicated, he said 90 days. An evidentiary hearing was held in regards to Ms. Cosgrove, who SB's mother made the statement to. And in the course of that statement, the court noted on the record that Ms. Cosgrove's testimony was very fluid as the court questioned her credibility. The court also made a comment specifically, I'm not sure how you're going to find anything else in investigation beyond what we've heard here. These are statements made by SB's mother to Ms. Cosgrove. Do we believe Ms. Cosgrove or not, essentially? What else is there to do? It's interesting to note that at the time of the defense's last motion continued, the defense noted to the court that that they had not even scheduled their investigator to investigate this issue until the week of the scheduled trial, reminding the court that earlier, 90 days before, the court was very clear, we're going to trial on this case. You have to be ready. How much time do you need? The state would submit that it would appear that the defense was trying to get their severance motion granted by not performing work on the case that maybe wasn't necessary anyway and asking for a continuance. Would be speculation, but at any rate, the fact is that there's no indication that the defendant was prejudiced by denial of the continuance.
Are you familiar with the Higgs case and our holding on that?
Yes, and I think much like the Higgs case, in this case, the state would submit that, you know, what the Higgs case basically, you know, came down on was to say, well, wait a second, how is, you know, has the defense had an opportunity to examine? How has the defense been prejudiced in this matter? The state would submit very similar to that, that in this case, there's been no showing that there's been any prejudice to the defense. And clearly, the defense had ample opportunity to perform their examination and investigation. In regards to the other issues that have been laid out in the briefs, the state would submit in regards to the admission of the hearsay statements that clearly the evidence code provides that, in fact, those statements come in. There's actually three sets of statements. This all relates to SB, and it would be statements made SB to her mother whispering in her ear. Clearly, those come in as an excited utterance. The state would submit clearly, and also under 51385. Statements made by the mother after hearing these, just kind of repeating them, as she's sort of in shock at the moment of hearing her daughter say these things. The state submits clearly they come in under a present sense impression and excited utterance. And then also statements made by the child a little bit later to her father. The state would submit that clearly they come in as well. It appears my time is up. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Sweden. Mr. Westbrook, you'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
A lot of differences between Higgs and this case, but primarily the biggest difference of all, aside from the complete record that we made as to why we needed the continuance, was the fact that we were ready on 23 counts related to a completely separate case. We were trying two cases at once, not one case. Higgs was trying one case. It's a vastly different circumstance. Furthermore, to Your Honor's earlier question regarding the three continuances, my recollection from the record is that we did not have complete CPS records even after the third continuance. That's typical. It's very difficult to get CPS records. When you add another state's bureaucracy on top of our bureaucracy, it becomes double difficult. Regarding Ledbetter, here's the other reason why Ledbetter is different from this case. In Ledbetter, motive was more important because in Ledbetter, it was his own biological children, was it not? My recollection is that Ledbetter was accused of molesting either his own children or stepchildren living in his house. I believe it was his own biological children. But regardless, an obvious defense would be, what kind of man would do that to his own children? That's not an issue in this case. These people were not related to Mr. Stiles. And delving into his motive is not important. If it was that important, why is there instruction specifically requested by the state that says we don't have to prove motive? They don't have to prove motive. They don't want to prove motive. They're supposed to prove facts. And motive is immaterial in this case. Regardless of the defendant's motives in a charge like this, if he did it, he's going to be convicted if the state can prove it. Motive was not an issue here. Now, regarding, you know, Forrest Gump and the arguments about whether or not the state has to prepare for defenses that haven't been presented, I'm not a smart man, but I do know that the state can't open its own doors. The witness that was just talked about, Tina Allen, that was a state's witness. The testimony that was presented by the state. So what happened here is that the state presented a witness who said that the kid was all over Stiles and was very outgoing and expressive the entire evening. And then based on the evidence that they presented, they then said, well, that evidence is out there, so we have to be able to counter that and counter the possibility of a mistake or accident defense by presenting these other bad acts. They can't open their own doors, and that's exactly what they did. And that certainly can't justify the inclusion of a videotape, which, again, could not have been more prejudicial. The minute that videotape was shown, you could have accused Chester Stiles of shooting JFK or Richard Nixon, and he would have been convicted of it. Because at that point, the jury lost the ability, as most normal people would, to calculate the evidence in that separate case. They couldn't do it. It's incredibly difficult under the circumstances, and it's not a surprise that they were not able to do it. Now, of course, it's important that the state talk about the Buchanan case as not being weak, because they know that if it is weak, there's no way it can possibly survive harmless error analysis. And I think that we've shown that if you apply harmless error analysis to the Buchanan case, it doesn't hold water. There's no way this error can possibly be harmless. But the fact is, there was no arrest made. If it was a strong case from the outset, an arrest would have been made. An arrest usually is made. The law is incredibly favorable to the prosecution on sex cases. You don't need corroboration. People can be convicted of a sex case in a crucible-like atmosphere where all there is a statement of one person, and it's uncorroborated, and it doesn't make sense, and the conviction can still stand. If this were a strong case, Chester Stiles would have been arrested. If it were a strong case, the state might not have had to rely on a videotape from another case to get a conviction. But that's exactly what happened here. There are lots of issues. I know we've focused most on the severance issue because the severance issue.
Could you comment quickly on the summit issue?
Absolutely. There's no question that we had a right to this cross-examination under summit. And the reason there's no question is because the district court ruled that we had the right to it. Now, had we been able to pursue the CPS records and all this other evidence, that would have bolstered the type of questions we would have asked pursuant to our summit motion. We weren't able to do that again. But having ruled in our favor on summit, not once but twice, ruled in our favor, there was a hearing, ruled in our favor again, we went into that trial knowing that we had the right to a certain cross-examination. And then mid-trial, the rules changed. And at that point, Mr. Stiles' Sixth Amendment right to effective assistance of counsel certainly went right out the window. You can't change things midstream. We were already unprepared on the Buchanan case. That made the problem worse. I'm asking you to do the right thing in this case. I know it's a hard decision, but due process demands it. Please reverse.
Thank you.